In 1939, when he was 10 years old, Noam Chomsky wrote his first editorial. It was on the fall of Barcelona in the Spanish Civil War, and it was published in his school newspaper. By the time he was 30, Professor Chomsky had initiated a revolution in his field of linguistics, one that continues in lively debate today. And by the time he was 40, he was thought to be the most articulate and forceful spokesperson against the war in Vietnam. It's 1992, and in the intervening years, Professor Noam Chomsky has continued to do what he believes intellectuals in this country should do, to pursue the boundaries of his field and to speak the truth as he sees it. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. I hope you'll join me now as we talk with Professor Noam Chomsky. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
I want to start with some questions about the free press, if you will. We in this country believe that we exist with a free and open press. We may criticize it from one side or the other as being too left-leaning or too conservative, but in general, we don't believe that it's controlled in any way. You, with Edward Herman in your book, Manufacturing Consent, say it's not true, that there are controls put on the press. Can you open a window for us?
Well, I think the United States, in one respect, has probably the freest press in the world. I don't know of any country where the press is so free from any fear of state intervention. So in England, which is not a very different society, the police can go into the offices of BBC and take their files and ransack them and so on. And in fact, there isn't really even a formal guarantee of freedom of the press, let alone an operative one. That's inconceivable in the United States. So in that respect, the press is very free. It's free from government censorship. It's free from control. To the extent that the press decides to conform to state power, that's a choice. It's not imposed at the through the barrel of a gun. On the other hand, from another point of view, the press is, you might even say, quasi-totalitarian. That is, the nature of the output turns out to be extremely conformist and remarkably reflective of power interests, not just state interests, but also corporate interests. And what we did in this book, and has been done in many other books and studies, is to document that over a wide range of cases. Now, so here we have a situation in which the press is certainly very, nobody's telling a columnist what to write, nobody's telling an editor what to print, but the output is extremely similar and very much supportive of power interests and very distorted often. And that's the kind of thing that just comes out of institutional facts. It comes out of the nature of the media as an institution. And if you think about what they are, it's not terribly surprising. In fact, as we point out in the book, a kind of virtual free market model would predict this. The media are differentiated, of course. They're not one homogeneous group, but at the core of the media, there's what are sometimes called the agenda-setting media, the elite media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the CBS, a couple of others. And they provide a kind of a basic framework within which most of the media operate. So if you're an editor of a small town newspaper in Iowa, you don't have the resources to go out and get the news in Africa. And what you do is adapt to whatever is on the front page of the New York Times that morning. In fact, even the TV stations do this themselves for their evening news. Now, if you look at the agenda-setting media, the ones that are kind of framework-setting, they are huge corporations. They're linked to even bigger corporations like General Electric and Westinghouse and big conglomerates. Like other corporations, they have a product and they have a market. The market is businesses, mostly big businesses, advertisers. The product is audiences, and they sell their audiences to their buyers, the advertisers. That's in effect what the media are. For the agenda-setting media, the privileged audiences, relatively privileged audiences, are the ones who read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and so on. So what you have is major corporations selling privileged audiences to other businesses. Now, what comes out of that interaction is a way of looking at the world which reflects the interests and the needs and the concerns of the sellers and the buyers and the market and the product. If anything else were to happen, it would be amazing. Quite apart from that, there are many other pressures which tend in the same direction. So, for example, if you're a reporter who has to write a story about some disarm some armaments issue or some foreign affairs issue and so on, the easy way to write the story is to go to a government bureau or to a corporation or somewhere where they will be delighted to give you lots and lots of material, glossy photographs, statistics. So they'll write the story for you if you want.
They're the ones we consider the experts.
Well, they have the resources to present you with the picture as they want it seen. Suppose the reporter happens to want to get a different picture. Say they want to see what the American Friends Service Committee has to say about it. Well, you know, they don't have the resources. I mean, you can find somebody in their office who'll talk to you, but they are not going to deluge you with prepackaged, controlled information. They wouldn't want to do it if they could, and they can't do it anyway. Now, this generalizes across the board. If the easy life. Furthermore, if you present the government's point of view, you don't need any evidence. You don't need any argument. You say the United States is defending freedom in Central America. You don't need any argument. If you say Gaddafi is an international terrorist, you don't need any argument. You just say it. Suppose you say George Bush is an international terrorist, or the United States is trying to destroy democracy in Central America. Well, all of a sudden you need evidence properly. You should have evidence. Of course, you should have evidence for the other one, too. But when you start, and then the standards, the editorial standards you have to meet start rising. Pretty soon you have to prove your points by the standards of physics, you know. So Ray Bonner was basically thrown out of the New York Times because he didn't have enough witnesses. Independent witnesses to a report of torture directed by American soldiers in Central America. Though there's very little doubt that the story was true. If he wanted to have a story about torture by Salvadoran guerrillas, he could just say he heard it from somebody who told it from somebody else and so on. Now the effect of all of these things, there are many such factors. The effect of it is to, almost invariably, these factors bias the media towards conformity, which is the less expensive way, it's the less hazardous way, it's the way that reflects the interests of top cultural management in any event. It's also true that the media elites, editors, columnists, and so on, they share class interests with other elites. In fact, there's a sort of a free flow between the corporate, the executive suite, the government office, the editorial office, and so on. They're the people who play golf together. They go to the same parties. In fact, they themselves can shift around among the positions, and that adds another, an element of class consciousness and sharing of perspective that again affects the media product. The people who become really very prominent, very prestigious in the media. The commentators like, say, James Reston of the New York Times, who's James Reston, to a large extent, made his career, as did Arthur Kroc, as do his contemporaries today, by being outlets for people in power. So James Reston would have lunch with Secretary of State Dean Acheson, who would leak to him the State Department's version of what was happening. Well, that's a leak, and that's a story, and that's news, and nobody else is going to find out about it for 30 years until the documents come out. And now Reston can write an insider's column, you know, saying, well, unidentified sources in Washington say, you know, so-and-so. And he has a scoop. That's the way you get to be the leading columnist in the country, that kind of thing. If James Reston were to stop presenting, stopped presenting the world from Dean Acheson's point of view, he would have lost that access. He would have lost the scoops. He would have to try to figure out what's happening from the outside. He'd have to become I.F. Stone. Well, I.F. Stone did a very good job of it, but of course I.F. Stone was cut out of the media. Nobody wanted to hear that story. The end result is that every columnist can say perfectly honestly, nobody's telling me what to write, but the columnist wouldn't be there unless he or she, usually he, was writing basically the right thing. They wouldn't make it to that position. They wouldn't be able to hold that position. Well, these are all factors that interact in all sorts of ways without any specific decision being made. They're institutional facts about the media, which end up giving a highly conformist and also highly distorted output very often.
More quickly, what's the effect on the participatory democracy? What's the effect on me when I get done reading the New York Times or listening to PBS?
We don't have democracy in that sense, and we're not supposed to have it. Well, there's a theory of democracy that prevails in elite circles, and that theory is that the population is not supposed to be part of the game. And that goes way back to the foundation of the Republic. This country was founded on the principle that the people who own the country ought to govern it. That's the favorite maxim of John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And in fact, it's the basis of the federalist system and so on. And that goes right up to the present. If you read, it's very interesting to read the theories of democracy that are put forth in progressive elite circles. A very interesting case is Walter Lippmann, who was
He called us the bewildered herd.
Yeah, for him, the public is the bewildered herd. You know, they have to be out of things. Their job is to be spectators, not participants. It's a small group of what he called responsible men who are supposed to run things. Now, Walter Lippmann didn't say, either because he was too naive to understand or because he was suppressing it, but he didn't say what it is that makes him a member of the responsible men, but not somebody who has different opinions. And the answer, of course, is that Walter Lippmann was presenting the world from the point of view of people who have power. If he hadn't, he wouldn't have been part of the responsible men. So it's true that you'll get a group of executives and managers who will be the responsible men as long as they serve real power, which, and what it is in our society is not a big secret. It's basically concentrated corporate power. That's where the basic power in the society is. That's where investment decisions are made and decisions about production and commerce, and in fact most of the decisions that affect life are made there. And since the resources are also concentrated there, as well as the decision-making power, that very heavily affects what happens in the governmental apparatus and in the media and the educational system and so on. Now, if Walter Lippmann was serving those interests, he could be one of the responsible men. And he could say most of the rest of them are the bewildered herd who have to be kept out of trouble. And that is the operative theory of democracy. People are not supposed to participate, they're supposed to watch. What they're supposed to do, as is commonly said, is that just what they did yesterday in New Hampshire, every couple of years they're supposed to say, I want you to lead me or I want you to lead me, but then they're supposed to go home and watch the tube. That's the end of democracy. That's a very limited conception of democracy.
How should it work? When the politicians are campaigning and they come to our community?
Okay. Well, I think it should work quite differently. Let's take the New Hampshire primary, which has just been on the television set for a couple of weeks. It strikes me that the whole structure of it is deeply anti-democratic. I mean, what happens is half a dozen candidates come to a small town in New Hampshire, and each of them gets up and says, here's my program. I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. Well, first of all, everybody who's listening to them knows they're not going to do it. You know, the relationship between campaign promises and performance is a very weak correlation, and most people understand that. But even if they were intending to do it, it would still be deeply undemocratic. Now, let me suggest another model. Another model is somebody decides, I want to run for public office. And what they do is go into a town in New Hampshire and they say, what is your program? What program have you worked out for your community and for the country? I want to know what you think we ought to be doing.
And presumably New Hampshire has sat down and talked about this.
Yeah, and then there would have been political groups or other organizations in that town which would have been thinking about it. They would say, look, this is what we want to happen in our country. And if this guy comes in, we will tell him or her what we want. Now, if that person says, okay, I'll do what you want, we'll let them speak in our name. And if they stop speaking in our name, we'll throw them out. You know, we'll get somebody who will speak in our name. Now, that's a radically different conception, but that's democracy. Now, we don't even have a conception of democracy in the country. Nothing like this ever happens. People are not supposed to get together and to work out their interests and concerns with one another and put them in the political arena. They're supposed to select X, Y, or Z to be their leader. Now, that's a kind of elective dictatorship. That's not democracy.
Well, it's also conceivable that letting someone else deal with this has led to something of a helplessness in the country. I think we're overwhelmed with drugs, poverty, wars, the economy, layoffs.
Well,
we don't know
I
how
think
to sit
that's
down
true,
with our
but we're overwhelmed in a funny sense. There is no mechanism to address the problems. There's I don't want to say no mechanisms. I mean, people can meet in their church, let's say. I mean, there are few structures that still exist. And in fact, insofar as there is independent politics in this country, it's remarkable to see to the extent to which it comes out of the churches. That part of the reason is they exist. You know, there aren't any unions. There aren't any political organizations. There are no political parties. There are no political clubs. There's very little. I mean, there are other informal organizations, things like the various, say, Central America Solidarity groups or women's organizations or environmental groups and so on. Those are elements of real democracy. They actually involve people thinking about some aspect of their world or their society and proposing things, but they are so peripheral in our system. Now, of course, there is another sector, the corporate sector, the business roundtable, which is the, and other business lobbies. They do exactly what I've described. I mean, they, in fact, very consciously and with huge resources propose programs, and of course, to say that they're lobbies is a little misleading because they're basically lobbying their own representatives in Congress or the executive, and they have so much clout that they can be very effective in imposing their interests. And then there are special, you know, you'll get special lobbies on particular issues, the gun lobby or something like that, but they're usually very narrowly focused issues. But the questions of the kind you mentioned, say the real ones, I mean drugs, economic decline, unemployment, and so on, these are not matters that citizens are organized in any way to deal with. So of course they find the problems overwhelming. All they can do is listen to what somebody else says about them. They can't get together with others and suggest something. In fact, they're not even supposed to think about it.
A slight shift. You're not in any way a nationalist, is my understanding. You have certain assumptions about power, that power defends itself, explains itself to suit itself and to protect its wealth and its influence. And is that what keeps you from being a nationalist?
Well, you know, I mean, with regard to personally, nationalism isn't my cup of tea. I mean, I don't like it, you know. If some group of people wants to identify, a nation doesn't mean anything. I mean, a nation is a group of people who say we're a nation. You know, it's very hard to find another criterion. If some group of people decides that they want to associate with one another and have shared cultural values and shared interests and call themselves a nation, in my view, that's fine. You know, everybody ought to have the right to do that, and there could be as many overlapping ways as you can imagine. But personally, it's not my cup of tea. What I don't think is that any of these groups have a right to oppress others or to use to take control of a state. A nation state is a very dangerous thing. A state doesn't, you know, a state is typically a representative of, it's the nature of the state reflects almost invariably, maybe invariably, the decision of actual power inside the society, the distribution of actual power, which is always very broadly distributed. Pick any society you like, you, and ask who makes the effective decisions that matter. And there's always a very narrow group of people, and it has to do with control over resources and over productive institutions and so on and so forth. It can be a military bureaucratic elite like the Soviet Union. It can be a network of corporate power as in the United States. It can be some other thing. But there's always some distribution of power, and groups and individuals rank very widely on this spectrum. And what the government does typically reflects, it's called the national interest, but it's actually typically the interest of the most powerful sectors inside that society. And that's a dangerous structure. That's why I've always been an anarchist. I don't believe that there ought to be state power free from popular control. In fact, I doubt very much that most state power is even legitimate.
We're talking today with Professor Noam Chomsky. You're tuned to Conversations on KUAC-FM. Noam Chomsky took his BA, MA, and PhD in relatively short order from the University of Pennsylvania, all in the subject of linguistics, a field in which he's worked since prior to that time, actually. He is, as you may well have guessed, and as my introduction indicated, an activist in the United States, an intellectual activist, and a political activist, very critical of the United States, especially of its foreign policy over the last 30 years or so. I want to ask you about your belief in anarchy. Most of us would say it's the dictionary definition. It's a state of chaos, a state of unrest.
Yeah, that's not what it's ever meant to anarchists. What it
is
meant for, well, I mean, of course, anarchism means, you know, all sorts of things. But in the mainstream anarchist tradition, which is not very well represented in the United States, used to be strong in the United States, but it was wiped out by state violence.
30s?
It was wiped out by Woodrow Wilson and his Red Scare very largely. It was a lively, I mean, those are the days when Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman and the IWW and so on were live, important elements in our life. They were wiped out by largely state repression. It's not that we haven't had a repressive state, we have. But that tradition regarded anarchy or anarchism as a highly organized society, but one which was organized on the basis of voluntary association and federal arrangements and popular control. And in a sense, it has links to Jeffersonian Enlightenment ideals. It's not identical, but closely linked in many respects. So in a certain way, it's a very authentic American tradition way back to the origins. It's one phase of the American intellectual tradition back to aspects of Jefferson, not the whole story, but aspects. You know.
It presupposes that the working people make the decisions about the economy and the politics?
It presupposes that everyone make decisions in whatever institutional structure they participate. So if you're a worker in a factory, it's your factory and you decide what happens there with regard to character of work or nature of investment or whatever. If you're in a community, you make the decisions about what happens in the community. Now, in fact, every human being is a member of many overlapping structures like that. Like you can be a worker in a factory and a member of a community at the same time, and those two interests may, in fact, conflict with regard to, say, how the industry ought to invest. Well, that's where a democratic process comes into operation, with different kinds of associations interacting to yield decisions about what should happen. Now, we have a very different system. We have a completely hierarchic, authoritarian structure. Say a factory, since you bring it up, but it works for any institution. A factory is simply the translation into the economic sphere of fascism. I mean, it's hard to imagine something more fascist than a business enterprise. There's the owners on top who have ultimate total control. There are the managers who make the decisions subject to the fact that they could be fired if the owners don't like it or the stockholders. Then the decision-making flows downward, always downward. At each level, you have nothing to say to the person above. I mean, you can make a suggestion if you like, and if they don't like it, too bad. You basically have no rights. For example, middle management level, people have basically no rights. A middle manager can be thrown out tomorrow, you know, told, you know, clear your desk, I don't want to see you anymore. I know people whom that's happened in their 50s. If you're a worker down at the bottom, you have some rights, the rights that came from struggle, from many years, you know, 100 years of committed struggle over state violence, which was extreme in the United States, business pressures, ideological pressures, and so on, finally gave ordinary working people some rights, the kind of rights that were won through the labor struggles and the union struggles. They're limited. In fact, they've been declining over the years. But apart from that, you basically have no rights. The structure's totally authoritarian and in principle, and of course in practice. And that influences every aspect of the society because, in fact, in that very narrow interlocking category of owners and top managers, in them is vested an enormous amount of power and an enormous amount of control over resources, and they naturally use it, as you'd expect, to influence and control every other aspect of life.
The worker is the tool.
Yeah, you're a tool. You're supposed to be. You rent, the way the system works is an individual rents himself or rents herself to the owner of capital. That's what you do. We don't have slavery. We have rented labor. A person can survive if they're willing to rent themselves, to say, okay, you own me for this period, and I do what you tell me for that period. Well, you know, that's a deeply anti-democratic conception. And in fact, you had to beat it into people. It took a long time before people were willing to do that. Part of the origins of our mass education system was an effort to discipline an agricultural community of independent people so that they would be willing to, or at least would agree to, be obedient tools in systems of this kind. It's one of the reasons why teaching obedience and conformity is such a central part of the educational system.
What does... It sounds like the anarchy that you describe reflects a very different view of human nature than does the democracy we believe we live in. What's
different? Very different.
How do you look at
it? It's different,
us?
And I could very well be wrong. I mean, these are questions of fact, but the assumption of anarchists or I don't like to use the word libertarian because it has special meaning in the United States, but the traditional kind of left libertarian thought, that assumed that people have what Bakunin called an instinct for freedom. That is, people want to be free. They do not want to be controlled. That it's an infringement on their essential human rights to be dictated to by others. It does assume something about human nature. It assumes that you do not want to be ordered about and told what to do and diverted and so on, but you want to take control of your life. That could be wrong. I mean, it could turn out that humans really are slaves and the slave owners were right. You know, that's what the slave owners claimed. They said human nature is such that most people are born to be beasts of burden, and that's what they like, and that's the way they are. Well, conceivably that's correct, but libertarians have never believed it. You go right back to Rousseau and others in the 18th century who talked about how people were born to be free, and if they're in chains, it's because, as they are everywhere, it's because of social institutions and conflicts and so on, which have taken free people and put them in chains, but they ought to break out of the chains.
Once again, we're talking with Dr. Noam Chomsky. He is what is known as the Institute Professor at MIT, Institute Professor of Linguistics, and has been such since 1976. He's been a full professor of linguistics since 1961. In 1988, he was awarded the Kyoto Prize for Basic Science. It is Japan's equivalent of the Nobel. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. We're talking today with Professor Noam Chomsky. Is it at all possible for anarchy, as you describe it, to replace something like the democracy we see ourselves as having today?
I think it's constantly replacing it. I mean, I don't think that anarchy in this sense is a goal to be reached. It's sort of a tendency to be extended. You know, and in fact, if you look over history, including around recent history, there's continual breakdown of authoritarian structures, and there's continual expansion of the realm of freedom. So take the first point you raised about freedom of the press. Freedom of the press and freedom of speech is in theory given in the Bill of Rights, but that's only in theory. It didn't exist.
Parchment barrier, it was
called.
That's
James Madison's parchment barrier, which he derided. He said a parchment barrier will not protect people from tyranny. You have protection from tyranny if you fight for your rights, and you give substance to those words. It was a long time before those words had much substance in the United States. A famous court case in 1964, won by the New York Times, actually, established for the first time in American history the right to criticize the state. The courts ruled that the principle of what was called seditious libel was unconstitutional. Seditious libel really means it's a crime to assault the state with words. You know. Now, that was a big victory. That was in 1964. There was a bigger victory in 1969 when the Supreme Court, for the first time, adopted what I would regard as a real libertarian standard, namely the standard proposed by Jeremy Bentham in the 18th century. It said that speech should be free and unconstrained up to the point of initiation of criminal action. So, for example, if the two of us walk into a store and you're holding a gun and I say, we want to rob the store, and I say, shoot, that's not protected speech, according to this doctrine. On the other hand, everything up to participation in incipient criminal action is free. I think that's a real libertarian standard and a valuable one. And I think this may be the only country in the world that has that. But that was achieved by struggle. It was achieved by the labor movement and the civil rights movement, particularly in those years, and the women's movement later on, and other popular movements. And incidentally, those decisions are not always made on behalf of attractive organizations. So the 1969 case was won by the Ku Klux Klan. That's when the Supreme Court established that libertarian standard, and I think, you know, that's the cost you pay, the price you pay if you believe in freedom of speech. It's for everybody, crucially for the people you hate.
It's very hard for us to live with that. We don't want to protect the people we find hateful.
Well, see, I think Americans do. That's
we do.
Why Americans have the standards of freedom of speech that are unequaled elsewhere. In Canada or in England or in Sweden and other countries, they don't have these standards. But I think Americans, one of the attractive things about the population here is that they've been independent-minded enough and militant enough so that they have won rights like this, including the right of people who you despise to speak publicly.
So it is our willingness to struggle over these issues internally as well as externally in which you find the hope.
Yeah, that's what has expanded the scope of freedom. I mean, we've seen it just in our recent lifetimes. Take say women's rights. I mean, the situation today is radically different from what it was 20 or 30 years ago. Take say the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas affair, which was a total fiasco in my opinion. But if that had come up 30 years ago, nobody would even cared. So, you know, Anita Hill says she was sexually harassed, let's go have a beer or something. That's now at least understood to be an issue. And in fact, women's rights generally are understood to be issues. There's a form of oppression which was not recognized to be oppression, either by the oppressed people themselves or by others. Now, I don't want to overgeneralize. There's a feminist movement back actually hundreds of years, but it became a major, in fact, you find interesting aspects of it in, you know, 15th century Italy and places like that. But in the 1960s, it did take a different form. And it became part of popular, these issues became part of popular consciousness, including women's consciousness, to an extent that they had not been in the past. Well, that's a victory for freedom. That's the recognition of a form of illegitimate authority and a struggle against that illegitimate authority to expand the realm of freedom. And it didn't happen because somebody legislated it. It happened because people struggled for it and thought it through and worked on it and so on. And the same is true on every other issue. I mean, until the 1960s, the black population of the United States was effectively excluded from the political system. I mean, in the Constitution, which we prize, black slaves are described as three-fifths human. They're not human beings. If some third world country were to enact our Constitution today, we would describe it as a regression to Nazism. The Constitution literally describes certain people, black slaves, as three-fifths human. Well, you know, they technically got freedom with the Civil War, but it was technical. After the Reconstruction period, they were restored to something like, you know, other arrangements which weren't a lot different from slavery. They didn't have the possibility of voting, really, until the 1960s. That 1964 Supreme Court case was over that kind of issue. It was over a civil rights issue. Well, through very intensive struggle and very, very courageous, extraordinarily courageous struggle in the late 50s and the early 60s, those formal rights were won, and that expanded the realm of freedom. Now, that victory is a small one. That victory still leaves us with a situation where black males in Harlem, New York, have a lower life expectancy than their equivalents in Bangladesh. It still leaves us with by far the biggest prison population per capita in the world, overwhelmingly, very disproportionately minorities. And with all sorts of other forms of horrifying repression and subordination and subjugation. But it was a victory. It's better not to be lynched than to be lynched. You know, it's better than to have the right to elect a local sheriff than to be beaten bloody by the local sheriff. Those are victories. And these are very recent ones, you know, so I'm not talking about ancient history. That's our own lifetimes. And it's presumably will go on. You know, just I hope it'll go on. That's how the realm of freedom is expanded. That's how people find out what they are. You know, and I think, well, here again is this belief, you know, not proof, that what they find out is they want to be free.
Once again, this is Professor Noam Chomsky from MIT, from America. He has written at least 60 books, 60 that I counted, on his vita. The first was a small book of notes called Syntactic Structures. It assisted in the revolution of his field called linguistics. He has written far more frequently on Southeast Asia, the Middle East, Central and South America, on American foreign policy. Also on subjects we've been discussing today, intellectual freedom, dissent, human rights, and the changing times. Noam Chomsky, our guest today on Conversations. We're in a time right now, and we've both mentioned it in the course of this hour, that is quite troubled in the United States. Our economy seems to be tumbling. There's a huge division between rich and poor, a lot of layoffs, a lot of insecurity economically. In terms of human rights, our Supreme Court is moving to the right, which some people think is very good, other people think is disastrous. There seems to be persistent problems in the ghettos of our big cities, also persistent problems in rural communities, both social, economic, and also political, I would guess. Given that we seem to be stultified, where do you think we are moving next? Some people say a period of stultification opens up into a rainbow of change.
Well, I think it does open options, but we should at least understand what's been happening. I mean, these things happen because of conscious social policy. It just takes, say, the last 10 years, the Bush-Reagan years. There was a conscious social policy adopted in those years. It was pretty much bipartisan. In fact, a lot of it had been suggested, proposed in the last years of the Carter administration, then implemented by the Reaganites. And this conscious social policy directed, carried out a transfer of resources from the poor to the rich very dramatically. I mean, there's a reason why the society's splitting apart. In the last roughly 10, 15 years, roughly that period, the top 10% of the population has gotten considerably more wealthy. Incomes, in fact, increased by about 16%. The bottom 10% of the population has gotten much poorer. In fact, their income declined by about 15%. If you go higher, say, to the top 5%, the increase is about 30%. You go to the top 1%, the increase is about 50%. Well, this is one aspect of a shift of resources from the poor to the rich, carried out by conscious social policy. The Reagan-Bush program, it was not conservative. They are not conservatives. They are radical statists. They believe in a very powerful state. They believe in a welfare state, but it should be a welfare state for the rich. That's the Reagan-Bush system.
You're not joking.
I'm not joking. State expenditures, in fact, increased. They're big spenders. They're huge deficit spenders. They succeeded in converting the United States from the leading creditor in the world to the leading debtor in the world within about 2 or 3 years. They left the country with huge indebtedness at every level, federal, state, local, corporate indebtedness, household indebtedness. And all of this was to create a huge welfare state for the wealthy.
But wait a minute. Isn't this, if it's true in your mind, isn't it an example of goring the golden goose? I mean,
for whose purpose? See, if you suppose you're a corporate executive living in a Connecticut suburb and running a multinational industry or involved in an international bank or something, what do you want out of the country? What you want is a powerful state which will support your interests worldwide. You want security for yourself and your family and good schools for your family and so on. You want enough of a workforce to do the work that has to be done here, but not much of a workforce. After all, capital can flee freely. You can produce in Southeast Asia or in Haitian assembly plants. You can invest, you can have your financial affairs taken care of in the Cayman Islands in a little office, a quarter of the size of this room, which is called an international bank. And because there it's free from regulation and taxation and so on, so you can use it for drug money laundering or whatever you feel like. You can have your another executive office in Zurich. You're called an American citizen and you're called an American enterprise, but what you don't care much about is what happens in Harlem. In fact, from that point of view, In fact, you know, even the statistics are extremely misleading here. Like, people talk about the decline of the U.S. share in world trade. Well, if you look at what's produced in the United States, that's true, there's a decline. If you look at what's produced by U.S.-owned corporations, there isn't a decline. In fact, there's even a slight rise. It's just they're producing it elsewhere and picking up the profits here. Now, you know, to talk about a country or a nation or a state is already misleading. We're talking about very different groups of people with very different interests and different desires for the state. Now, the Reagan-Bush people, to more than the usual extent, I mean, it's always this way, but to more than the usual extent, they are the representatives of this corporation executive in Connecticut, and that's the social policy they designed. So, I mean, take, say, the Pentagon, which grew and expanded enormously in the early Reagan years. That's a welfare state. Don't kid yourself about it. The Pentagon is the system which compels the taxpayer to pay the costs of high technology industry. That's basically what it is domestically. It forces the taxpayer to pay research and development costs for the next generation of computers. If there's anything that can be sold, you give them to IBM and they make the profit. What we call private enterprise is a system of public subsidy and private profit. Furthermore, the Pentagon system compels the taxpayer to purchase waste production by high technology industry. The corporate manager knows he got a cushion. Anything that I can't sell, the state will buy from me, waste production, weapons, and so on. Furthermore, the state will act so as to ensure that there are plenty of foreign sales of this state-organized production. So just since in the last roughly year and a half, the United States has sold, I think, about $19 billion worth of weapons to the Middle East. Well, you know, that's a state-run market, and a state-guaranteed market for the benefit of the wealthy. That's why we have high-technology industry. The kinds of programs that we try to impose on the Third World, you know, free-market-type programs, they guarantee underdevelopment. No developed country has ever pursued such programs. None of them pursue them today, neither us, nor Japan, nor Germany, nor anyone else. But all of these are, and the Reaganites were particularly committed to a powerful state. In fact, their belief was that the public doesn't even have the right to know what the government's doing. One of the things that the Reagan-Bush people did was narrow quite significantly the access to government documents. See, one of the good things about this country is it was possible with a lot of effort to figure out what the government was doing because there was a lot of guaranteed access to documents. Well, they cut that back. In fact, they cut it back so narrowly that the historians of the State Department resigned in protest. The people who were involved in declassifying documents from 30 years ago, they resigned in protest, with a big protest, in fact, because, and they're very conservative historians, I should say, they resigned because of the unprecedented conditions that these reactionary statists were imposing to try to prevent the public from knowing what the government's doing. This is the opposite of conservatism. An old-fashioned conservative like, say, Robert Taft would turn over in his grave to see the word conservatism used for this radical statism committed to a welfare state for the wealthy. Now, I don't want to suggest that they're all that much out of line. That's pretty much what the government always is, for institutional reasons. But this was extreme. And we're paying the costs. I mean, the costs are being paid by about roughly 90% of the population whose incomes have either stagnated or declined, and they're being paid by future generations who are going to have to meet the unmet social costs. We talk about debt, but there's what's sometimes called a social debt of unmet needs, which you can't calculate, and that runs from potholes in the streets to deteriorating cities to lack of an educational system. I mean, look, we're the only country in the industrial world which doesn't even guarantee health care for people. That's just considered automatic everywhere else. And in fact, the current proposals are incredibly over-bureaucratized and inefficient because they are geared to the interests of the wealthy. George Bush's health proposal is just a gift to the insurance companies. It's going to create masses of paperwork far beyond the national health care systems of one purchaser, like, say, Canada, which are far less bureaucratized, far more efficient, but are not geared to the interests of the wealthy. Now, every country, every industrial country except for us has some such system. We don't even have it yet. So again, to get back to these initial paradox, we're a very free society in many ways, but we're a very backward society in other ways.
Once again, this is Noam Chomsky. You set the environment from your perspective for the question I asked, but didn't get to the question, which is all right, but let me ask it again.
I lost it somewhere.
That's okay. My sense is that this country is fairly stultified by its troubles. Many people believe that a period of stultification leads to a period of change. The fabric just gets too tight and begins to rip. I want to know if that's your perspective.
I think we're in a very dangerous moment. I mean, it has a lot of prospects. It has a lot of threats. In some respects, it reminds me of Weimar Germany. I mean, I don't want to overdraw it, but the public is very cynical. It's very dissatisfied. People don't believe anything. They regard everyone as a crook. You know, I spend a lot of time traveling around the country giving talks, and it's kind of remarkable to see that changes over time. I mean, dissidence, I'm convinced, is much higher than it's ever been in the past. Skepticism, cynicism, and so on. On the other hand, I think people would believe almost anything. You know, I'm convinced that if I were to go to some, you know, place anywhere, Midwest, say, and give some crazy story about how the problems of the country, you know, result from the fact that George Bush is an agent of Martians, you know, who drinks children's blood for breakfast or something like that. You know, make up any crazy story you want. A lot of people would shake their heads and say, that's kind of plausible.
Is this stress?
I think that's the result of depoliticization and marginalization. I mean, what you have is people who, in fact, even the polls show it. You know, polls consistently show that about half the population, when asked who runs the government, say something like a few big interests looking out for themselves, but those guys are all crooks. And the same with every other institution. Faith in just about every institution has been declining like this. On the other hand, there's nothing, doesn't seem to be anything to do about it. We don't have a method, modalities, you know, structures in which people can participate. Things like this hypothetical New Hampshire primary that I described, they don't exist, except for very scattered segments. The result is that people are in a position where they might be organized for very constructive moves to take their lives into their own hands and expand the domain of freedom and so on, or they might follow David Duke. And the same people could go either way. In fact, it's kind of striking. If you look at the actual detailed poll analyses, you find pretty much the same people who might go either way. And that's not untypical. It's not untypical of depoliticized societies where people feel that that something's going wrong, something's being done, and they're right, you know, something's being done to them that shouldn't happen to them, but they don't know what, and they don't know what to do about it.
Dr. Chomsky was educated from the time he was 2 until just about the time he was 12 in an experimental progressive school. You called it a Deweyite school. In Philadelphia, then later an academic college-oriented high school where he learned for the first time that he was a good student. He has taught all his life and done research. His earliest teaching was in a Hebrew school while he attended the University of Pennsylvania. Do you think that background set you up for, prepared you for the Noam Chomsky who is both a scholar and an activist?
That background certainly did, and that was only part of it. Of course, remember, this was during the Depression, and so some of my earliest childhood memories are people trying to sell rags at the door, and you know, people in really desperate conditions. Although I should say nothing like the poverty that we see today, bad as it was, you know, 25% of the population unemployed, including an awful lot of my family. It was nothing like the deep, hopeless poverty of today. But those are, or you know, other early childhood memories are being, you know, passing on a trolley car past a textile plant in Philadelphia and watching police just beating women strikers bloody, you know, as they're breaking a strike and so on. And then it's other childhood memories involve listening to Hitler over the radio and not quite understanding what's happening, but knowing that it's pretty awful and seeing the world crumble. and also being in a school that did foster creativity and independent thought, all of those things have an effect. Also, this was a time when there were, there was, first of all, a lively working class culture at that time. This was the time of the formation of the CIO and great labor victories and a sense of solidarity and working together and creating a better future and so on. So despite everything, there was a kind of a hopefulness which just doesn't exist today. It's remarkable in a way. I mean, here was a time when everything was falling apart during the Depression. About a quarter of the population wasn't working. We're nothing like that today. But nevertheless, it was hopeful. First of all, public services were working. You could go to the library. It was there. You could walk through the park. You wouldn't get killed. You could take the train to New York if I felt like it was running fast and on time. The working class culture was real. It wasn't just reading radical tracts. I mean, it was also arguing about the last concert of the Budapest String Quartet, and deciding whether to go to the union camp for 2 weeks off in the summer and stuff like this. And it was also the sense that you're working with other people. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when I grew up as a kid, it was just, to cross a picket line was like stealing food from a beggar. You understood that people need to work together in order to protect themselves. All of that's gone. All of this has been wiped out. Not totally, of course, but it's been very severely eroded. And what we're left with is a set of atomized people who are extremely hopeless. They don't feel that they have any prospects. They don't know what to do. They're living in the objective conditions of poverty in the inner city are really horrifying. There are parts of the United States that look like deep third world, not small parts either. But there's also a sense that nothing's ever going to get you out of it. In fact, this is an interesting moment in industrial society. As far as I know, this is the first time in modern industrial society in its history that children have not assumed that they're going to live as well or better than their parents. In fact, it's rather widespread, the assumption that, our parents lived in a golden age. We're never going to make it. We're not going to have the kind of homes they did or the kind of freedom they did or whatever. We're going to have to work harder and we're going to have less. That hasn't happened in the past, except in times of war or disaster or something like that. But there's a real turning point, and I suspect it's going to have some kind of psychic effect. Of an unpredictable kind, that the future doesn't look brighter. Even in the depths of depression in the past, the future looked brighter. Things were going to get better, and we were going to have a better life, and we were going to do something about it, and so on. A large part of the population doesn't believe that.
There's a psychic ladder that's not there anymore.
Yeah, and it's not the poor, necessarily. Like upper middle class kids, often, I can see my own students, people like that, or my children for that matter. They just don't expect to, and sometimes even don't want to, live the way their parents did. That's something new. And what that'll mean, I'm not sure. It's unprecedented.
Do you ever question for yourself whether you are an optimist or a pessimist or cynical or hopeful?
Cynical is a word I wouldn't like to use. It's very hard to describe yourself, especially accurately, naturally.
Always.
But I would like to be a realist. Now, to be a realist from the outside looks like being cynical, but that's because you should be cynical about power and authority. That's realism. Optimist or pessimist, it doesn't seem to me to matter much. You can look at the world and you see things that are getting better. You can look at the world and you see things that are getting worse. And how you decide to react to them is a matter of your own personality. Actually, I think the best answer to this was given by the Antonio Gramsci, the Italian left communist back who was jailed by Mussolini for most of his life. He said we should have pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. Mm. I think that's about right. You should not be Pollyannish about how you look at the world, but you should be optimistic about what can be achieved. And the reasons for that are pretty straightforward. If you're a pessimist of the will, if you're not going to try, you can be guaranteed that the worst is going to happen. If you are willing to try, there may be ways out.
Do we need more realists with that balance in this nation today?
I think it'd be a good thing. I mean, a lot of the people who are deeply committed to constructive social change are also, in my view, very unrealistic about the way things work. In my personal opinion, one example of this is the constant flirtation with exotic conspiracy theories. JFK is a case in point. Mm. I mean, I think that reflects a real misunderstanding of the way institutions work. And, you know, it's kind of, you can see why people latch on to these things. I mean, if we could only believe, you know, that things were really nice, you know, and we had this great ideal and we had this fourth, you know, this leader who was going to lead us into a marvelous future, and some bad people did something and took it over and stole it from us. If we can get rid of them, we can go back to where we were. If you can believe that, it's pretty comforting. It's just not true, you know, and we might as well recognize what's true. You know.
It's hard for us as a nation.
It's hard for people to, I mean, I don't know if it's hard or easy. It's also hard to deceive yourself. You know, to deceive yourself requires a constant effort to suppress things that are in front of your eyes. In some respects, it's easier to look at them and to see them and to see that there's good and bad. We haven't even touched on some of the most dangerous things. I mean, you know, we're coming to a point in human history where the human species may very well do itself in. That's not an exotic thought any longer. I mean, it's not clear what the time scale is for dealing with real problems. I mean, we could prove in the next couple of generations that the human species is just a lethal mutation. It has destroyed itself and much of life in what is an instant of evolutionary time. We could prove that. And it's not too far off. Nobody can give you numbers, but it could be several generations or even less. I mean, look, just this year's discovery of the hole in the ozone layer over the northern hemisphere, that's pretty frightening. That tells you something about timescales. And scientists just don't know. I mean, virtually all scientists, except maybe John Sununu, agree that these are really dangerous problems. There's virtually no disagreement about this. Nobody can tell you what the time scale is. There's too many uncertainties. But that things are going in very dangerous directions with regard to many aspects of the environment in which we live, that's not in doubt. Unless we carry out the kind of cultural and institutional change that'll confront these problems, other questions may simply not be open for solution.
Professor Chomsky, I want to thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to Conversations today. Our guest, Professor Noam Chomsky. If you're interested in his writings, as I said, there are at least 60 books. The most recent, Deterring Democracy, was published by Verso in 1971. Manufacturing Consent with Edward Herman, published in 1989. Necessary Illusions, Thought Control in Democratic Societies by Southend Press, also in 1989. There are many more, including works in the field of linguistics. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. I hope you'll join me again next week.